Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with the Pantograph of Friday, October 30th, 2020. Let's move to page one, where our first page one story is headlined, COVID Rules Hit Logan County. This story is datelined Bloomington. A region stretching from Logan County through Springfield to the Mississippi River on Thursday became the latest to face new restrictions because of rising COVID case numbers. Business owners still recovering from measures put in place last spring say they're worried about the long-term impact. "It's going to hurt," said Martin Leon, owner of the Lincoln restaurant El Mazatlan. "When we first shut down, the first couple months we struggled with to-go orders because there weren't a lot of people ordering from us. And when we opened back up, business improved significantly. When days are cold, we feel that people don't get out as much because people are afraid to go inside the restaurant." The restrictions for Region 3, southwest of McLean County, prohibit indoor bar and restaurant service, closes those establishments at 11 p.m., and limits the size of gatherings to 25 people or 25% of a room's capacity. It is the ninth of 11 COVID-19 monitoring areas to be placed under resurgence mitigations to slow the spread of the coronavirus. The region has had a 7-day rolling positivity rate of 8% or above for 3 straight days, beyond the threshold set by the state. The rate was 8.8% on Thursday, and the restrictions are lifted when rates improve. Something has got to give, and these mitigations aim to cut down on those high-risk activities until we bring down the positivity rate in an area once again, said Governor J.B. Pritzker at a press conference. "When every single metric in every single corner of the state is trending poorly, we have to take meaningful action to keep our people safe." The mitigations do not apply to schools or polling places. Logan County Health Department Administrator Don Cavey said the goal is to make sure that everybody uses common sense and follows through accordingly. "Hopefully, this will be temporary and we can get through this phase here fairly soon." The Region 3 rules will kick in at 12:01 a.m. on Sunday. The area includes Hancock, Adams, Pike, Calhoun, Jersey, Green, Scott, Brown, Schuyler, Cass, Morgan, Macoupin, Montgomery, Christian, Sangamon, Logan, Menard, and Mason counties. The designation is the first time a central Illinois region has had restrictions in place. The regional approach was adopted after Illinois instituted closures of non-essential businesses and other activities last spring. The two sections still resisting crackdown are Region 2, including Rock Island, Peoria, Bloomington Normal, and Pontiac, and Region 6, with Decatur, Champaign-Urbana, Danville, and Charleston, but cases there are also increasing. On Thursday, a woman in her 90s who was a resident of a long-term care facility was McLean County's 37th coronavirus-related death. 19 new cases of the coronavirus also were reported in McLean County on Thursday, bringing the total number of cases to 4,270. There were 9 people hospitalized, none in intensive care, 352 people isolating at home, and 3,872 people considered recovered. Other local data released by health departments on Thursday show a woman in her 70s with COVID has died in Ford County, where there have been 15 deaths. 32 new cases in Tazewell County, where a man in his 70s and a man in his 90s at Timber Creek Rehab and Healthcare in Pekin with COVID have died. 16 new cases in Livingston County, and 11 inmates at Pontiac Correctional Center have tested positive. A woman in her 70s with COVID also died. The LaSalle County Health Department was notified of 2 women with COVID who died, one in her 80s and the other in her 90s, as well as 30 new cases. That county has had 68 deaths and 2,577 cases, with 1,859 recovering. Meanwhile, in Logan County, the total number of confirmed positive cases was at 637 Thursday, including 549 people who have recovered, 83 active cases, and 5 fatalities. Since the pandemic moved into Illinois in March, 9,675 people with COVID have died. The Illinois Department of Public Health reported another 6,363 infections on Thursday, with 56 additional deaths. Pritzker, who has weathered criticism this week from the bars and restaurants that lose business under the rules, went public in Chicago Thursday to showcase his release of $94 million in grant funding for businesses and communities struck by the pandemic. He said there's $19.5 million for bars and restaurants specifically. And in all, Pritzker said the money will be distributed to more than 1,200 businesses and 163 communities that requested reimbursements of their emergency costs. But Marcy Eads, co-owner of Mama's Arcade Cafe in Lincoln, said the additional restrictions are unfair. "My first thought is, I don't really find it necessarily fair that we get lumped in with bars and that kind of thing. We're a small diner, and we're following all the protocols and all of the rules," she said Thursday. "We're complying with everything. I just don't understand why they can't separate the bar and restaurant issues." Eads said she worries what will come next. "It feels like we're just going to be shut down and be done," she said. "We're not going to be able to reopen at full capacity. We're not going to be able to survive." Adam Antonez, manager with Daphne's Family Restaurant in Lincoln, questioned the timing. "I think it's nonsense before all of the elections. It's going to hurt a lot more other businesses, smaller ones," he said. And he said, "I think it's unfair for him to use the authority to close everything down. We're planning on staying open until either the health department tells us to shut down or we're going to get lawyers to go after him." Cavi said the department has received some complaints about restaurants not complying with COVID-19 guidelines, but have not had any major issues. If the department continues to receive complaints about particular restaurants not complying, they can pursue issuing warning letters and then suspend licenses if the issue persists. He said the county numbers are better than the region, but we have to act as a region. "The sooner that we can get everybody to comply, not only as a county, but as a region, the quicker we can get back on our feet again," he said. And there's a little sidebar to this story that's headlined, 783 tested at fairgrounds on Thursday. McLean County Health Department Administrator Jessica McKnight on Thursday said the county was working with the Illinois Department of Public Health to clarify information the state released Wednesday. State health officials had said the county had 2 additional deaths, which would have brought its total to 38 residents, but county health officials on Wednesday had continued to report 36 total deaths and said they were investigating the state's information. McKnight said Thursday that the other death reported by the state, a woman in her 50s, was found to be a resident of another county. McLean County is working with the state to correct the record, she said. A total of 783 people were tested on Wednesday at the McLean County Fairgrounds COVID-19 testing site, the McLean County Emergency Management Agency said on Thursday. And our next front page story is about election 2020. It's headlined, "Trump and Biden Campaign in Florida." It is an Associated Press story, datelined Tampa, Florida. Pressing against stiff headwinds from the pandemic, President Donald Trump steered toward what he hoped was safer political ground with the U.S. economy on Thursday, as Democratic rival Joe Biden kept up his assault on Trump's handling of the coronavirus. campaigning hours apart in Florida, a state all but essential to the Republicans' pathway to another term, both candidates urged supporters to get to polling places in person, even as a tropical storm interrupted early voting in the Southeast. The shift to focusing on in-person voting next Tuesday, or sooner where possible, comes as more than 80 million Americans have already cast their ballots absentee or by mail. And while the Election Day vote traditionally favors Republicans and early votes tend toward Democrats, the pandemic, which has killed more than 227,000 people in the U.S., has injected new uncertainty. "You hold the power. If Florida goes blue, it's over," Biden told supporters Thursday. Trump on Thursday was celebrating a new federal estimate that the economy grew at a stunning 33.1% annual rate in the July-September quarter, by far the largest quarterly gain on record, making up ground from its epic plunge in the spring when the eruption of the coronavirus closed businesses and threw tens of millions out of work. "So glad this great GDP number came out before November 3rd, Trump tweeted, predicting a dire reversal if Biden is elected. But economists warned that the economy is already weakening again and facing renewed threats as confirmed viral cases surge, hiring has slowed, and federal stimulus help has mostly run out. Biden said, "The recovery is slowing, if not stalling, and the recovery that is happening is helping those at the top, but leaving tens of millions of working families and small businesses behind." The Democrat is framing his closing arguments to voters on what he describes as responsible management of the COVID-19 pandemic. Trump, instead, is arguing that Biden would undo the economic gains of his administration with stricter virus-targeting public health controls, though those are largely what scientists are calling for. "The people are tired. They can't do it anymore," Trump said of lockdowns. Trump and Biden both visited the western end of Florida's Interstate 4 corridor, an area known for rapid residential growth, sprawling suburbs, and its status as an ever-changing hard-fought battleground during presidential elections. The president had been scheduled to hit another Sun Belt battleground state, North Carolina, on Thursday evening, but canceled his event in Fayetteville as Tropical Storm Zeta brought wind gusts reaching 50 miles per hour to the area. On Friday, Trump is to visit three upper Midwest states, and he will hold a trio of rallies on Saturday in Pennsylvania before launching on a whirlwind tour of battlegrounds, including Florida, Michigan, Georgia, and Pennsylvania in the closing 48 hours of the race. Biden, meanwhile, heads later in the week to three more states that Trump won in 2016, Iowa, Wisconsin, and then Michigan, where he'll hold a joint Saturday rally with former President Barack Obama. Biden's campaign also announced that he will visit Minnesota on Friday, hours before Trump holds a rally in one of the few Clinton voting states that Trump is hoping to pick up this year. The pandemic's consequences were escalating, with deaths climbing in 39 states and an average of 805 people dying daily nationwide, up from 714 2 weeks ago. The sharp rise sent shockwaves through financial markets, causing the Dow Jones Industrial Average to drop 900-plus points on Wednesday. Trump, who frequently lauds rising markets, failed to mention the decline. Stock prices recovered somewhat on Thursday. Trump is betting on the GOP's vast field and data operations and efforts known as poll flushing, monitoring precinct lists for who has and has not yet voted, to provide a late boost on Election Day. The Republican National Committee, which has more than 3,000 field staff and claims more than 2.5 million volunteers, will use that information to reach out to Trump supporters to ensure that they get to the polls. Nowhere may those efforts be more important than in Florida. Without the battleground state's 29 electoral votes, Trump's path to victory is exceptionally difficult. On Thursday, Trump was introduced in Tampa by First Lady Melania Trump, who praised her husband's presidency, saying, "Under Donald's leadership, we have blocked out the noise and focused on you, the American people." Trump is banking on local news coverage of his visit to overcome a substantial advertising deficit stemming from a late cash crunch. Biden and his allies are outspending Trump and his backers by more than 3-1 in Florida, about $23 million to about $7 million in the final push to Election Day, according to data from ad tracking firm Kantar CMAG. Biden, meanwhile, is pouring tens of millions of dollars into a torrent of online advertising that will deliver his closing message of the presidential campaign, highlighting his promise to govern for all Americans while blasting Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. "I will work as hard for those who do not support me as those who do," Biden says in one of the digital ads, which will take over the masthead of YouTube.com on Thursday. "That's the job of a president, the duty to care for everyone." And our last front page story is a big local one called Football Palaces, a look at all the football fields in the Pantograph area. And it is accompanied by some beautiful shots of football fields from the area, some taken at sunset, some taken in bright sunlight, some taken from overhead. And the story will cover 25 area fields from Bloomington to Streeter. And it's written by Jim Benson. The scene is repeated on Friday nights in the fall throughout the area. Friends, family, and fans stream from the parking lot to watch their local football teams compete. The smell of pork chop sandwiches, bratwurst, hot dogs, and popcorn are in the air while walking to the stadiums and fields. Marching bands get everyone revved up. Cheerleaders and sometimes members of the student body hold up a banner that the team charges through before the opening kickoff. Those sights and sounds aren't there this year, with high school football being pushed to the spring because of the COVID-19 pandemic and state restrictions. Followers of their favorite teams are left to think about past games and hope everything will return to normal a year from now. To keep everyone in the football mood, we have compiled a list of stadiums and fields in the Pantograph area. Hopefully, it will conjure up many great memories and keep you longing for a return to Friday night lights. Thanks to athletic directors and coaches for providing information and photos. The first field is Fred Carlton Field at Bloomington High School. The field was completed in 1929 and named Davis Field in honor of former Supreme Court Justice David Davis, a Bloomington resident. The name was changed to Fred Carlton Field in 1944 following the death of Carlton, a 27-year engineer of schools. And new grandstands were added in 2010, a new track in 2013, along with a new scoreboard in 2017, and field turf was laid in 2018. Football coach Scott Godfrey says, "This football field is a big-time high school venue. We have top-notch facilities, and there is no place like Fred Carlton Field on a Friday night. I still get goosebumps each time I take the field or drive by, knowing that I get to coach there each season." A Normal Community High School. The stadium opened in 2003 when the school moved to the east side. The most recent addition was the Josh Rogers Memorial at the south entrance to the game field. Rogers was a former NCHS student and football player who was an Army Ranger sergeant when he was killed in action in Afghanistan in April 2017. Football coach Jason Drengwitz says, "I have been coaching football at NCHS for 17 years, and there have been so many memories that I will never forget. In general, I love how Friday nights and home games at NCHS bring our student body, families, players, coaches, and community together. I cherish all of the time spent in the stadium with our current players and coaches, as well as all of our former players and coaches. Normal West High School, Wildcat Stadium. The field was opened in 1995 during the first year of the high school. Wildcat Park, an area inside the stadium with a pavilion and bench seating, was dedicated in the honor of Brian Baker, a Normal West student and football player who died of cancer in 1996. Central Catholic High School, Bill Hundman Memorial Field in Bloomington. The Saints moved to their east side location in 2005 and began play on the field named for former Central Catholic player Bill Hundman. The facility has a grotto and a statue of Hundman, who died in a traffic accident in 2004. Football coach Ben Brock said, "Tradition, family, and go Saints. People might forget that Saints football has had many homes over the decades. Although many of the storied Central Catholic football teams never played on this field, many former players, parents, coaches, and alumni had an instrumental role in the development, fundraising, and building of this great facility." University High School, Hancock Stadium in Normal. Officially opened in 1963 and named after former Illinois State head football coach and athletic director Howard Hancock, in 1969 it became Illinois' first college stadium with artificial turf. The stadium was renovated in 2013, which included a new east side grandstand with bleacher back seating and a 55 square foot indoor club that is accessible to ISU club seat holders and a new press box. The new Daktronix video board and sound system were added in April 2014. Athletic Director Steve Evans said, "There is nothing better than looking up in the stands and seeing all the students cheering on their friends, laughing or smiling, and enjoying the Friday night lights. It is a night where a large group of students and parents are truly enjoying the atmosphere and supporting the Pioneers." Pontiac High School, Williamson Field. Named for A.C. Williamson, a former Pontiac High School coach and administrator, the field opened in the third week of the 1968 season. Decatur St. Teresa beat Pontiac 19-12 in the first game on the field. Athletic Director Gary Brenner said, "There have been a lot of great games on the field. One was probably against Montini in the Class 3A semifinals in 1993 before I got here. Another was a playoff game against Joliet Catholic, the 2000 Class 4A semifinals, where they beat us in the last seconds." Prairie Central High School, Lewis Field in Fairbury. First opened in 1948 and was most recently renovated this summer with the addition of new home bleachers and a press box. Lewis Field first opened as a new field for Fairbury High School. The field was named for the Lewis family, who donated the land for the high school and athletic fields, and the former football field is located at the center of the current high school building. Football coach Andrew Coyne said, "One of the unique parts of Lewis Field is that it is an east-west field. Early in the season, the sunset is a factor, and the wind can be a big factor come playoff time. In 2006, in an opening round playoff game against Pontiac, a kick going west went through the uprights before being blown backwards onto the field of play. Hawks went on to win 15-6. Athletic Director Austin Wenger said, "Being a Prairie Central alumni, I have several memories of attending games at Lewis Field on Friday nights while growing up, as well as memories of playing a couple years of high school football here myself while Coach Phil Morrison was the head coach. Getting to see first-year head coach Andrew Coyne leading the Hawks into a quarterfinal playoff game at Lewis Field last year was exciting. But my favorite memories of this field were watching my younger brother, Nathan Wenger, and his team go undefeated in the regular season on their way to a state runner-up finish in 2003. Olympia High School, Stanford. The field has been in use since 1972 when the school opened. Tri-Valley High School, Viking Field in Downs. Construction of the field at the school began when Tri-Valley, which was in a football co-op with Leroy, decided to have a team of its own. The Vikings had a freshman to junior varsity squad in 2001 before its first varsity season in 2002, which resulted in a playoff appearance. Former football coach and athletic director Brian Knutson said, "Steve Epperson was the superintendent and said, go out and build this field. The beauty of it was built by the community." Tom Morrison from the Downs Department of Maintenance and Steve Brady were instrumental in it, and Howard Springer built the press box. It was really a town effort. El Paso Gridley High School. El Paso, EPG's artificial turf field was installed during the summer of 2013. An 8-lane all-weather track was also installed around the field. The first game on the new field was August 30th, 2013. Hayworth High School and Hornet Stadium. The field opened in the fall of 2008. Hayworth was the Heart of Illinois Conference co-champion the first year the field was used. Fieldcrest High, Veterans Park in Minunk. This field opened in 1999 with former football coach Jim DeMay getting credit for heading the project. Football coach Michael Freeman says it's home to some pretty rocking Friday nights. The noise is filled with cowbells, noisemakers, horns, and of course, fans cheering on their beloved Knights. Crisp playoff games in November are unforgettable there. McCollum Field in Eureka High School. Named for former football coach Warner McCollum, the field underwent its last renovation in 2012 with new home and visitor stands. Football coach Jason Bachman said, "Have I done my best today?" This quote hangs on the wall going into our home locker room. It was brought to my attention by a past Hornet football player that played for Coach McCollum. And Jim McDonald Field in Mackinac, part of Deer Creek Mackinac High School. This artificial turf field was dedicated in 2018 and is named for the former Chiefs coach who served for 25 years, compiling a 179-83 record that included 21 winning seasons, 19 playoff appearances, 8 conference championships, and a Class 2A state runner-up finish in 1987. Jim McDonald at induction ceremony said, "I am overwhelmed. I'm obviously humbled, to say the least. It's great for the community. The community built the program. For them to have this, they really identify with all their sports. Football is very special to them here, and to see them get this football field makes me very happy." And L.A. McKean Field at Leroy High School. Home to Leroy football since 1937, L.A. McKean was the head football coach of Empire Township High School, or Leroy, and Leroy High School from 1920 to 1936 and 1942 to 1945. His record was 102-83-10 with 4 undefeated seasons. Football coach and athletic director B.J. Zalesnik says, "There are big old maple trees that line the western edge of our facility. Each year at the end of October, those leaves are bright red and orange. The fields are plowed under. You can smell grill smoke in the air." And we are going to have to finish this when we get to part two because I'm at the end of the recording. This has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, October 30th, 2020. We'll go to part two soon.